Oh, hello there, everybody. Today is, I think it's the 9th? Yes, Wednesday, July 9th, 2014. My name is Luke Thomas. This is my weekly live chat here on MMAfighting.com. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm happy to have you here, like Mr. Rogers, I suppose. Today on the chat, we will talk about what just took place. So UFC 175, the Ultimate Fighter 19 finale, and there's a bunch to unpack and discuss there. We can also look forward to what was or what was supposed to be with the cancellation of UFC 176, what that means, what it doesn't mean, and what it means for you and me, I suppose. And of course, with every chat, same thing we always do, whatever you want to talk about, whatever I want to talk about, whatever you guys have really on your minds, ask me, and we'll all talk about it. So best place to do that is on MMAfighting.com, where this little window joker has a dedicated post. Questions that turn green get priority, or you can hit me up on Twitter at SBN Luke Thomas. You can also email me luke.thomas@sbnation.com. People, by the way, were asking what does SBN stand for? SB Nation, and SB stands for Sports Blog Nation. SB Nation is not just a site, sbnation.com, but a network of blogs, all team blogs for all the NFL teams, colleges, that kind of thing. So, MMA Fighters is a part of that, but not in the same way. You get the idea. All right. So with that out of mind, we have a couple of housekeeping announcements before we kick this off, because I just got to do it. You're noticing I'm wearing this spiffy red jacket because it's a wonderful jacket to wear, but it is July, and it is Washington, D.C. The temperature on deck is, 80 degrees, but it's hotter than that because it's 100% humidity, and, you get the idea. So why would you wear a jacket in D.C. in July? Well, you really wouldn't, except that I have to bury the shame that comes with losing a bet. If you guys don't know, Guilherme Cruz, who is our reporter out of Brazil, he and I made a bet for the quarterfinals of the World Cup. As you might know, my wife is Colombian, and so we had bet that if Colombia beat Brazil, he would have to sort of record a message and say humiliating things about Brazil. If Colombia beat Brazil, or rather, excuse me, if Brazil beat Colombia, which they did, however controversially, which they did, I would have to wear a Brazilian jersey. So, with that in mind, I wanted to get this out because we didn't lose that bad to Germany, Jeremy. I mean, we lost, but and the funny part about it is, the bet what I had with Guilherme about losing to Colombia was basically a way to humiliate Brazil if they lost to Colombia. Turns out I didn't get that, but Germany did it for me. But a bet's a bet, Guilherme. A bet is a bet. So I'm not wearing that stupid yellow one because yellow will always belong to Colombia for me. But here we go. There's my Brazil jersey. You win, Guilherme. You win this time. Another housekeeping note. You might remember that the last show we did, the last podcast, someone sent me some A1 steak sauce. And that was kind of funny because it was just a joke about some of the things I talk about. So I'm sitting here getting ready, and the office manager comes up to me and she goes, "Hey, there's another package for you." I'm like, "How is that even possible?" So I swear to God, I'm not making this up. You can see the package. Like, they sent it to me. Here's the pack. I just got this. I don't know if there's a delivery date on this thing. So I open it up. There's like a bunch of this in there, just, bubble wrap, whatever. And I swear to God, I'm not making this up. This is like a true thing. Someone sent me this, which is like both the nicest thing in the world and like slightly embarrassing that, my own viewers have to help me out with equipment basics, but it's more than basic. It's like super nice. It's a microphone, obviously, to do these. And I didn't have time to set it up this time, but because of your wonderful contribution, I will set it up for next time. And so we'll have microphone quality moving forward because of you. It's from a dude. I won't give out his name, except except you can follow him on Twitter at DarkToby, TobyY. He says, "I hope this helps improve your audio. Someone complained about it on Reddit. Please make an RSS feed soon. Please let me know if you receive this on the show or Twitter. Kind regards from Norway, Dark Toby." Is that crazy or what? You guys are it's honestly like moving how sweet that is. It's really incredibly kind. It's a show that I have the most ghetto podcast on the planet, but thanks to your contributions, it's actually a lot less ghetto now. So thank you, Dark Toby, and everyone else who puts up with the unbelievably poor quality of this little thing that I do. With that out of the way, we're 10 minutes into this. I got to get to questions. Thank you, Dark Toby. Let's go ahead and kick this chat off, shall we? By the way, if you hear this, you know the drill. Jesus. That means Diet Dr. Pepper today, which, by the way, is lukewarm. Let folks know you're watching. Get on Twitter, get on Pinterest, get on Instagram, Facebook. Tap someone on the shoulder in the line at the bus or the airport or the metro. Let them know you're watching this. Help spread the word, because with your contributions, like this microphone, this can be a bigger thing than it is. All right. With that out of the way. All right, first question. Sorry, it's a fair amount of questions here. All right, Chris Weidman breakdown. Post UFC 175, there was a bit more info on Chris Weidman now that we saw him fight and go the distance with Lyoto. How would you describe him as a fighter with his strengths and weaknesses? Would you say there's still truth to the statement that he improves every time he fights? How about him improving his stand-up game to be able to hold his own against arguably two of the best strikers in the 185-pound division with Silva Machida? You know what's funny about that fight was that I noticed, first of all, he seems very coachable, which is, I think, the most important attribute. Before we get to the stand-up part, let me say one thing that I think is undeniable about Chris Weidman's takedowns. He actually has better wrestling for MMA than I think most guys do. And what I mean by that is his takedowns along the fence are not that great, but they're not supposed to be that great. Like, taking someone along the fence, it only really works on mid-level to low-level fighters. It doesn't really work on someone really, really good, at least not consistently enough. You saw that in the Kevin Lee, Jesse Ronson fight, for example. It's like it's hard to take someone down against the fence. I mean, you can do it. It's a lot of energy. It's a lot of defense involved now. Guys have gotten a lot better at it. Chris Weidman's takedowns, he can do this stuff against the fence too. I don't think he's that great at it, but he's really good at getting guys in the middle of the cage. That's where your wrestling really shines. I actually have been making this argument a long time. I think wrestling is really good in MMA, but it was kind of like degrading a little bit because guys were getting lazy by just running someone into the wall and trying to scoop them out off their heels. And now what you find with Chris Weidman is he's getting a single or a double, then turning the corner right in the middle of the mat where there's really no cage involved. So it's one thing that really should be noted about Chris Weidman that I think deserves some attention. But as far as the stand-up goes, you know, you don't look at him and there's nothing like him. Like with Machida or Silva, you know, you always sort of thought, like, man, he's got these crazy ability to do stand-up, and he's got these unorthodox kicks and his amazing timing. Chris Weidman doesn't seem to have any of those tools, except if you tell him to go do something, he just goes and does it, right? Like, if you look at him, he's got great timing. He's got strong defense. I give him those two things. I thought he looked a little bit quicker this time around, at least in the first three rounds, but the reality is he just has an ability to exact on a detail that you provide him. I don't know that he has any particular skill set that I would point to and say, wow, what an amazing thing he does in this regard. He understands tactically what has to happen and then just goes and executes it with strong defense and good timing. I mentioned he's very coachable before. I think the trick to Machida is that Machida doesn't really, from my vantage point anyway, you can't bait Machida into fighting your fight. He either fights what he's going to do or he just doesn't really have much to answer. Which is why Chris Weidman, through those first three rounds, the game plan was perfect. March him backwards. Right? Machida needs time and space and distance to feint, work his footwork and his distancing, and then blitz. Right? That's what he needs. He needs space to operate. If you're constantly backing him up, and then throwing kicks to the body, throwing kicks to the leg, working in jabs, working in jab hook, he really doesn't have a whole lot of answers. That's the way to beat Machida, is just simply you have to make him not allow, you can't allow him to fight like Machida fights. He's got one gear. And if you allow him to do it, he'll eat you up to pieces. But if you don't, he's actually a pretty manageable task, or at least easier said than done. Chris Weidman did exactly everything he was supposed to, walking him down, getting the right distance, you know, making sure he was minding his P's and his Q's, peppering up in all distances, all different sides, just sort of taking him out of his game, stealing rounds with takedowns late, you know. It was an excellent, excellent performance. He really has the best thing I can say about Chris Weidman, aside from, like, you know, he does have decent striking and he does have good wrestling and so forth. And he's big for that weight class too. He just really has an excellent respect for tactics. Now, I know he let his foot off the gas in that fourth round, and the fifth round was, you know, a little bit closer, but you know, that's what made the fight exciting, I suppose. But I think that's what I'd say most about him. You know, Jack Slack and other guys like that, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the individual tactical things that he did. But I don't, like, there's nobody to really walk away and say, well, he's really, really good at this sort of thing, maybe with the exception of the wrestling, which I highlighted. I did think his jab was pretty good. I thought the frequency of his strikes was pretty good. I thought the mixing them up was really excellent. But for more than anything, if you look at this fight and the last fight and some of the other fights too, he just has a really, really strong appreciation for how to tactically manage each individual task. And which is why I have high hopes for him against people like Jacare and people like Luke Rockhold, although those will be, you know, interesting and difficult challenges as well. All right, let's see. Let's see. With BJ Penn finally announcing his retirement, looking back, what do you think is his legacy that he left behind in mixed martial arts? Certainly, there's, on the promotional side of things, he was the guy to make lighter-weight fighting popular. I think there's no doubt about that. I just think, though, that he was one of these guys who he blended the two things you want. I mean, you often hear this talk about, well, he's a fighter, not an athlete. He's an athlete, not a fighter. You know, GSP, he's an athlete, not a fighter. I think certainly a lot of the talk about BJ and a lot of the talk or the narrative around him was about his warrior ethos coming from Hawaii and, you know, just scrap. He really made a point to underscore his warrior interests and identities. But the truth be told is that, like, he's the first non-American to win the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, or first non-Brazilian to win the, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu World Championships. He was one of the first guys who was cross-training with Freddie Roach and the Marinovich brothers. You know, he was also a really good athlete. So he had all those things where, you know, he could, you know, hold knuckle up with you, and he was ferocious and licking the blood off his gloves and that sort of thing, and, you know, go to bjpenn.com and then running out of the ring, all those sorts of things. But the reality was, he amazed you as a technician. They called him the prodigy for reasons, because he had all the, he had, at the time when he was really coming up, if he had lacked one or the other, I don't think he ever would have been much. At the same time, though, I think he's also, you know, and that's all the good side. On the bad side, he's a test case on what happens when you just don't manage your career properly. Obviously, he was a major success, no one could say otherwise, but, you know, jumping the weight classes and having these battles with different organizations and, you know, not training really hard for the second Hughes fight. You know, I remember before the second Hughes fight, the Hughes rematch, he was saying, I'm just going to go surfing. I remember reading an article on InsideFights.com where he was saying, I'm just going to go surfing. That's going to be my preparation. And it was like, oh, my God, like, what is he doing? And he almost won. He almost won. But at the same time, Guillermo is. Wait, what? Hold on. If someone is having, yeah, it's an issue. I was like, time out. If you're having an issue with the YouTube video, I'm going to tweet the YouTube link as it is. Hang on. And you can just watch on the YouTube page. Hold on, just 1 second. Go here if you're having trouble. Okay. What was I saying? Oh, about BJ. So the legacy is also that, like, fighting across the weight classes and not being prepared for a lot of those fights. I think it also sort of tells a story about his career. But the, you know, listen, the real story about his career is one of unbelievable success. First ballot Hall of Famer, you know, and everything else you could possibly want. But, you know, promotionally, his legacy is this was the guy that built lighter weight fighting in terms of being a, you know, guys who, I think the fight with Diego did, I want to say over 700,000 pay-per-view buys. Let me pull that up just to be sure. But like, think about that today. Like, we're talking about Chris Wyman versus Lyoto Machida, maybe not even doing. Here we go. UFC 107. Not quite. It did 620,000, but still, you know, in Memphis, Tennessee. I think that was the one Rampage was supposed to be on for a time, anyway. Isn't that wild? 620,000. Can you imagine Ben Henderson or Anthony Pettis fighting anybody doing 620,000? It would take a lot. Ben Henderson, excuse me. Anthony Pettis versus Jose Aldo wouldn't even do 600. Wouldn't even do 500,000. You know, we're in a different pay-per-view climate these days. I'm just sort of pointing out that Penn was that guy. Penn was that guy. So I wrote on Twitter, haven't gotten nerves before an MMA fight in a long time. Someone asks, you tweeted that out prior to the Wyman fight beginning. My question is, when was the last time that the fight gave you legit nerves? Wild guess would be UFC 168 with Wyman Silva 2. If not, which fight was it? Wyman Silva 1 would be that one. Luke, with the recent announcement of the cancellation of UFC 176, what type of ramifications, if any at all, will this show with the oversaturation of events that the UFC has increased over the last 2 years? From a talent standpoint, do you see the company either employing more fighters to make sure that cancellations like this don't happen? Do you see them eventually scaling down cards over the next year, or will the company make no changes to their higher card output and risk canceling another event in the near future due to weak attendance and lack of named fighters on the events? Yeah, someone says, you already know Luke is going to say oversaturation. I am, but not in the way you might think. I mean, listen, what did I say last week? And I'm going to bring it up again. Oversaturation has a lot of different... There you go, thanks. It impacts all the different portions of the business differently. It impacts Bellator in a certain way. It impacts World Series of Fighting in a certain way. It impacts Fight Pass. It impacts Fox Sports 1 cards. It impacts Big Fox. It impacts UFC in different ways. And not every time and not all the time and to varying degrees. People always keep looking for this oversaturation boogeyman that you got. There it is. Like you're looking for the color red or something. It doesn't quite work that way. It's a fluid thing. And the margins of it can be hard to pinpoint. But to me, this is a pretty obvious case, right? As an organization, they're running so many shows. They didn't lose both fighters, by the way. They only lost one. Like, Chad Mendes is healthy. And they didn't have anybody on the roster who could reasonably headline a pay-per-view. That's a problem. How deep of a problem is certainly up for debate. But that's a problem, right? I mean... That should never happen, ideally. These used to be cards, and the UFC was built on the idea that mixed martial arts action is chaotic. Number one, it's chaotic. So we have to build cards that are stacked. If something happens, there's a lot more that you can still enjoy. That's problematic in this case. Number two, they would always say, we're going to do everything that boxing doesn't do. Right? We're not going to give you just one fight and then a bunch of BS undercard fights. There's a case to be made that they're moving closer to the boxing model because the boxing model works. You can get a lot of sales by just having a great headliner. You know, it's not necessarily clear you have to have a middle of the road, or rather, other fights on the card that can do wonders. Although I would argue that if you built your brand on that, deviating from it has costs down the line. But neither here nor there. And so the common response was what? Well, that's for pay-per-view, Luke. I mean, yeah, that card can't do well on pay-per-view, but it could do well on Fox Sports 1. And I agree. But even still, we're not really sort of thinking this problem through. It's true that if you take a pay-per-view card, a UFC quality in 2014 pay-per-view card, and you subtract the headliner, could the rest of that card go on Fox Sports 1? Sure. But that's not really evidence of the roster not having issues. That's simply evidence that... Fox Sports, like everyone's like, well, all that proves is that it's just that oversaturation is an issue for pay-per-view. It's not an issue for free TV. It's simply not the case. Free TV will also suffer if the card lacks a different degree of star power. Now, is that degree the same threshold as putting content behind a paywall? No, of course not. It's a much higher standard. I understand that. But it's not true that you can just put any old thing on TV and it'll just do well. Not the case at all. There has to be promotion behind it. There have to be recognizable names. We saw with Ben Henderson, the guy doesn't really sell that well on pay-per-view, but because of that prolonged Fox exposure, people might be willing to watch him on free TV. He might have become a free TV kind of guy, and that's success. But it's simply not the case that you can just put anything you want on TV and it'll sell or it'll do well. And the reality is a pay-per-view card is naturally going to be featuring a few more heavy-handed names. Removing the headliners still makes that better than the majority of the cards that they put on Fox Sports 1. This is not evidence that there's no oversaturation. Guys, there's no debate about oversaturation. It's a real thing. We're not going to debate whether it even exists. It exists. The question is, what are the contours of it? What does it do to the sport? Are there some positives? What are the negatives? And how do they impact the sport, both in the short term and the long term? And these are actually really kind of difficult questions. There is no oversaturation boogeyman. It impacts each individual event very differently, very subtly sometimes. Or it may have a major impact where you have to cancel an entire event. Excuse me, postpone it. You get the idea. So it's simply not the case that you go, I'll just put whatever we want on Fox Sports 1. It'll sell. It's just not true. About what it means for oversaturation, I mean, we have a bunch of different ways we can look at it, you know. I don't even want to get too much into it because there's probably a thousand questions. But for me, the key point, because it affects different cards differently, since we're talking about pay-per-view, UFC has an obvious star power problem, right? I think we can all agree about that. They do have some stars, not as many as they used to, and the ones they have don't sell like they used to, right? Jon Jones should be selling millions of pay-per-view buys. He doesn't. Ronda Rousey should be 500,000 and above, and she doesn't. Right, so also we have to acknowledge pay-per-view is not what it once was, but you get the idea. So to me, that's a star power issue, but that's not divorced from, at least not entirely, that's not divorced from oversaturation. When you have that many cards, it's really hard to buckle down and focus and promote these guys properly. When you're having guys fight overseas, it's hard to keep track of their careers. It's just, there's a reason why the NBA could go. The NBA could go global. You don't think NBA could go global? It's a global sport. It's an Olympic sport. You know the criteria they have to solve to become an Olympic sport and how MMA doesn't even come close to qualifying? It's a global sport, but they don't. They don't because it really dilutes the product. And it makes those are star-driven sports too, you know? I mean, if any league is a star-driven league, it's the inmates run the asylum over in the NBA. Right? That's a player's league. There's a reason why they don't. It's not because they can't. Right? There's a case you made to be limiting your product to preserve some sort of integrity about it. And the UFC is trying to do two things. They're trying to be the premier league, and they're trying to be a league that controls the pipelines to other emerging talent. And can you really do both on a global scale? I do not know. I have some sincere doubts about it, though. We're going to find out. Let's see. What do people have to say about that? I think the question is very relevant going forward because the UFC has now canceled two fights within 2 years because they're stretching the fighters. Yeah, here's the thing about that UFC 176 card. Like, if you take out the headliner, it's a good card. It's a good card, man. Like, Musashi versus, Musashi versus Jacare? Like, that's a really good fight, you know? Hold on, let me see. Although I heard he was bitter on Facebook. Did y'all see that? Because he found out through, they canceled it. Let me see if I can find a UFC 176 fight card. It's actually still on UFC.com. Ah, they removed it. Dagger. Here we go. Yeah, so take out the headliner. Jacare versus Gegard Mousasi, good fight. Gray Maynard versus Fabricio Camões, okay. Betch Cohea versus Shayna Baszler, that's important, obviously. Jussier Formiga versus Zach Murkowski, awesome fight. James Vick versus Lazaro, no. Lorenz Larkin, Derek Brunson, it's okay. Bobby Green, Abel Trujillo, it's okay. Tony Ferguson, Danny Castillo, really good fight. Benil Dariush, Tony Martin, it's okay, and Alex Garcia versus Matt Dwyer, it's also okay. There's a couple good fights in there, you know, some legit fights, but from a star power perspective, is anybody on that card a star? A star. Like, you could take that fight card and go to somebody in the know, and they'll be like, dude, these are some legit fights, and they'd be right. And then you could take this fight to a casual, take this fight card to a casual fan and be like, I don't know who any of these people are. And you have to appreciate that difference. Ronda Rousey's challenges. Rousey steamrolled her most well-rounded task yet. In 16 seconds, are we clutching at straws looking for genuine opponents yet? Yeah, man. Yeah, we are. Like, the reality is, dude, we're just, you know, I mean, imagine if you took Frankie Yeager in his prime, and or he's a little bit too small, but, you know, imagine if you took somebody like, I don't know, BJ Penn and sent him back to the early days and he was fighting people his size. It's a forced analogy, but, you know, listen, Daniel Cormier made a great point to me once about Ronda Rousey. Ronda Rousey, from the point at which she could even walk or move, has been training in and competing in at very high levels, if not the highest in some cases, like in judo, at athletics. Right? That's what she's been doing. She is, in his words, a lifelong athlete. That is a very different thing than these other women, man. These other women aren't necessarily bad athletes, but you're getting a lot of them, like, literally. I heard this one time from a woman who was Invicta and now in UFC. Yeah, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was looking to get in shape, so I walked into a gym and I just stuck around. Like, you're getting people who just showing up to the gym, you know. Now, that's not the case of Alexis Davis, who's much more accomplished, but point being is, first of all, athletically, they're just not even on the same level. And two, you know, well, with all due respect to sort of some of the talents that Alexis Davis has, and they are considerable, I just don't feel like we have the kind of fighter who technically has the answer. And I mentioned this before, like, who is the Machida of the women's side of the sport? Who is the Anderson Silva? Who is the GSP? Who is the John Jones? Who is, like, we're talking about one division, and it's so thin that no one can even touch the champion. You know, women's side of the sport is thin. I don't want to take anything away from Ronda Rousey because I think she deserves better competitors, but the elite kind of athletic woman just isn't there yet, man. She just isn't there yet. So no, like, maybe, you know, listen, would it be awesome if Kat Zingano surprised all of us and gave Rousey a good beating, or at least the fight of her life? Sure, that'd be awesome. Like, who would be against such a thing, particularly after tearing her ACL and then losing her estranged husband? I don't think anybody would be against that. But just speaking realistically, we're just not talking about the same kind of athlete. We're not. You know, it should tell you how much further the men's game is along that you get jiu-jitsu world champions in the black belt division who come over and get smoked. It should tell you that, like, all-time great wrestlers, albeit a different era, but all-time great wrestlers like Kevin Jackson come over and get smoked. It should tell you something that, like, that elite D1 wrestlers don't last in the men's side of the game sometimes, right? It's just a different reality. The men's side of the game, obviously for many clear and present reasons, is just so infinitely strong. And Rousey deserves those kinds of challenges, but they're just not there yet. The truth is, with Cyborg, you know, at 135, I just don't know what kind of Cyborg you're going to get. I just don't know what Cyborg you're going to get. And the whole point about, you know, everyone's like, why they fight him at a catch weight? And everyone says, well, the UFC doesn't want to do that with their champions, which I understand too. But it's a little more complicated than that. Like, there's a subtler story. Like, what did Invicta set out to do to mixed martial arts for women? Promote them? I mean, Strikeforce promoted women for a time. Bellator promoted women. Looks like Bellator is going to go back to promoting women. It's not that they don't get promoted. It's that they didn't get treated the same. Right, there was a time when they were fighting on three-minute rounds. That was one thing. But the real major insight, the real key, was that Invicta wanted real weight classes. If you looked at women's history in mixed martial arts all the way up through, 2010 and 11, even up until recently, the weight classes were so splintered, and people fought catch weights all the time, and there wasn't really any grouping of the talent. We're going to put you in talent. We're going to put you in groups. We're going to recruit and sort you, and we're going to build divisions. And that's not an easy thing to do. But that's what Invicta set out to do. Like, Invicta's always been a sort of a funny thing because they need to turn a profit to stay in business, but they act as women's MMA's nonprofit, which is to say their goals have nothing to do with marketability, at least not in the short run. Their goals have to do with, we're going to build this sport in the architecture that you need to build it to do it the right way. And hopefully long-term that makes money, which, by the way, there's no guarantee that it will, but But that's what they're trying to do. That's a noble thing. That's not something you're going to make a lot of money off of early. And then the UFC comes along, and of course, you know, UFC and Invicta have a unique relationship, let's say. And they come and strip mine their 115 weight class. Now, that's good for, I think in the end, that's good for women. I think the women like that. It's good for those individual athletes. A champion's going to be crowned as the season is called. But you get the idea that that's what they're trying to do. That's how far away the two sides of the sport are. You've got one organization whose sole goal is, like, we're going to do this sport the right way. And then you got the men's side of the game, which is basically modern elite prize fighting. It's just so far apart. Rousey is so far ahead of her time, it's just not even funny, you know. And you can say what you want about her, and, you know, everyone's got comments to make about Rousey, like they know her, they're her shrink or something. But she has no peer, and you need to accept that she has no peer. So if you're UFC and you recognize she has no peer, why wouldn't you make the Gina Carano fight? Is it the worst fight in the universe? Of course it is. But what are you going to do? We're going to put the number one contender up against her who lasts less, you know, the same amount of time you can put in an Instagram video. You know, why not make the Gina fight? The LT believes true or false edition. Luke Thomas believes that, I don't like doing much of these about me. I'll do this one time. Luke Thomas believes that after UFC 175, Weidman would be the favorite against every light heavyweight with the exception of the top three, Jones, Gustafson, and DC. Probably. I believe that UFC 175 will come in under 525,000 pay-per-view buys based on web traffic and other sources. Probably. Which is still pretty good. I believe that Penn versus Edgar would have been much more entertaining with the British color commentary yelling, and utter humiliation for Penn just got worse during the third round. I would have loved that. Not because I don't like Penn, but if you guys saw yesterday's Germany-Brazil game, after the seventh goal, which came like the 80th minute for Germany, or like 75th minute for Germany, the commentator literally goes with like enthusiasm, and utter humiliation for Brazil just got worse. I believe that Pizza Kingdom would be better off serving hot cups of A1 sauce instead of their coffee. I agree. I believe that Zuffa will be accepting applications for TV producers this coming week. Probably. I bet someone got a royal ass chewing for that. I believe that the only thing more oversaturated than UFC product was the ground in Rio from tears of Brazilian fans last night. There's a post on Deadspin, if you haven't seen it, about the headlines of Brazilian newspapers. It's like the saddest thing ever. Dear Luke, why did you cancel UFC 176? You're an effing sport killer, and I irrationally blame you for this, you MMA media nobody. All the best, McKinley Noble. What are you gonna do, guys? All that haranguing I've done has changed. I never understand how the MMA media is supposed to be viewed. You know, on the one hand, it's like none of us apparently know anything, and we should all be ignored. And on the other hand, everything's our fault. It's like which is it? Also, McKinley Noble, you can follow him at Ken the Great One, the number one. He is the what do you want to call him? The UFC rankings police. If you turn in an effed up ballot, you know, where some of your ranking is just like completely indefensible, he will tear you to pieces. It's kind of funny, actually. Gegard Mousasi, hi Luke, with UFC 176 being canceled, it seems the UFC did not tell all the fighters on the card. Mousasi wrote on his Facebook page, it's nice to know your fight has been canceled through social media. Good job, UFC. Why does the UFC continue to do this? I've seen fighters complain about this numerous times. Your thoughts? Well, if they don't call at all, I have a problem with that. But I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I want to say MMA media is going to find out about that kind of stuff pretty quickly. So the news is going to spread through social media or actual news articles pretty fast, right? You have to accept that. Second of all, you don't know how many of these guys who have been informed through an associate, and then the associate, there's a lag time between the associate and then the fighter. That could be the case as well, you know. Also, you got to call, you know, 30 donks on a card. It takes time to do that. So if they don't call at all and explain, whatever. but that's problematic. But if they're late to it, if they get beat, I don't think that's much of an issue, to be honest. Let's see. Let's see. Sean Sheehan, who is a jerk face, says, which is more embarrassing, losing the bet or having to wear a Brazil jersey or having to wear a Brazil... No, excuse me. What is wrong? What is worse, more embarrassing, losing the bet to having to wear a Brazil jersey or having to wear a Brazil jersey in all caps? Yes. Well, you know what's even more embarrassing? The fact that Ireland didn't make it anywhere. Let's see. They look into the crystal ball. In 5 to 10 years, how will BJ Penn be remembered? I've already answered that one. Bonus question, was that the saddest fight you've ever had to watch? No, I've seen sadder fights, but that was... Jesus. That was really bad. That was really bad. Two, in 5 to 10 years, how will UFC 176 be remembered? I think it'll be... I don't think that UFC 176, by any stretch of the imagination, is the last fight card they have to cancel. And I think it'll be remembered in collection with all the other cards that, in 5 to 10 years that have been canceled, which hopefully is not many, but it won't be the last one. By this time next year, what, if any, UFC champions will have lost their belts? People keep asking this question. Like, I any effing idea. Who wins the World Cup this year in 4 years? I would like to see a South America versus Europe final. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Netherlands are going to beat Argentina. And then between Netherlands and Germany, I don't know. Probably Germany, but I don't know. But what I would like to see is Germany versus Argentina. I would like to see at least Messi in a World Cup final. But I guess we'll see. Will the UFC's 176 cancellation end up being a good thing for the upcoming cards? Dude, canceling a UFC card, I know it sucks for UFC, but it's a win for fans. There's really no other way to say it. And UFC would probably be the first to admit that. You're going to get all those cards, all those fights, like, and you're just going to put them... Like, dude, Jacare versus... Musashi is on a fight night card now. Win. How do you not win? You win. Like that's a great thing for fans. Less cards should equal better cards in general. Does Frankie Edgar win a UFC belt again? Sure, why not? I don't know. Luke, last week's UFC post-fight presser, Dana was bombarded with questions concerning Ronda Rousey's next opponent. No one seemed to take much stock in Dana's words that there are many worthy challengers in her division to face her. Well, of course not, because there aren't. One reporter I read asked Dana about bringing Cyborg into the company, which Dana became belligerent with those in the press regarding how sick and tired he is about hearing about Cyborg being brought to the UFC. Dana then asked for a show of hands on who wants her to fight in the promotion, and almost all those in the press raised their hands. At this point, is it only a matter of Dana's ego not trying to reach out to her to bring her into the division to fight Ronda, who desperately needs some credible opponents? Do you think it's only a matter of time before she arrives and fights under Zuba's umbrella? It's a great question. It's a great question. I mean, listen, here's the reality. I actually think, and I said this after UFC 172, because I was there for that one, as you may remember, and I was there for the scrums. Dana's got a good argument, actually, about keeping her out or, no, not keeping her out. About being apprehensive about her. He has a good argument. It's like, dude, does it pass the smell test that she has never used? First of all, we know for a fact she's used before. And look at her. This, you know, we don't know medically how long this has been going on, but you're not irrational or crazy for thinking that this is a person who's had a long relationship with performance-enhancing drugs. You're not crazy. Do we really want to sign someone who appears to be that kind of a liability? Because here's the issue. Physical inspection of athletes is much stronger on the women's side of the game. If you're handsome like Luke Rockhold, or you're handsome like George St. Pierre, that's a bonus for your career, but you're not really put under the weight of that. The women's side of the game, you are, and Dana's guilty of doing this, by the way, but you are physically evaluated. And that fight would do big numbers. I truly believe a Rousey versus Cyborg fight, if promoted properly, if given the time to really nurture and sort of everything comes together as it should, that's a fight that sells, you know, 700,000 plus pay-per-view buys. I believe that. At a minimum, five. It's a big deal. And it would reach across to people in the press that normally don't cover MMA, much like most Rousey bouts would, times two, times three, times four, times five. You'd be putting your product deep into the microscope of inspection in the media, knowingly signing someone who has a serious problem, at least a history of it, a documented history of using performance-enhancing drugs, and who appears to look the part. Now, whether or not physical inspection of anything like that is fair or merited is completely irrelevant about whether or not it will happen and whether or not there are consequences to that and whether or not you want to eat those consequences in the name of putting on that fight. Because believe you me, people are going to bring it up over and over and over. It will be a part of the storyline of selling that fight. It'd be a part of every media interview that Ronda and Cyborg does. It would happen over and over and over again. Much more so than it would on the men's side of the game. Certainly Vitor Belfort, when he comes back, is going to have to eat it. But he won't gather, even in America, I think, she reaches deep into the casual fans, so the other side of the aisle. In the end, everyone's going to watch it. So the question is not that. The question is, could you legitimately damage your product and your champion en route to creating a fight that everyone watches? It's not a bad question at all. I kind of agree with Dana a little bit, that he has a right to feel like, this one is different. And maybe it's different because of BS sexist reasons or for the, you know, for things that just aren't fair. But they exist. And I don't think it's crazy for him to be apprehensive. In the end, however, what is the alternative? What is the alternative? You're just not going to sign her? You're going to let this fight pass you by? You couldn't make GSP versus Silva. You couldn't make Silva versus John Jones. You can't anyway now. Who knows if John Jones, Cain Velasquez is ever going to happen. Brock Lesnar ain't coming back. Like, these super fights, where are they, man? Where are they? There's one. And if not super fight, that's pretty damn close. What are you going to do? So the best thing they can do is, you know, maybe this is just some posturing on his part, but what are you going to do in the end? I think in the end what you have to sort of like come to terms with saying is that we're going to let her cut to 135, see how she looks, have her pass multiple drug tests, because what if they promote this fight and she fails a drug test before the fight? Oh my God, man, like just what are you going to do? There's no fill-in for Cyborg. Oh, we'll fill her in with, you know, whoever. Betch Kohea. Great. It's not the same fight. There's no substitute, man. There's no substitute. Dude, Dana White is right. He is right for saying timeout. This is not as simple as you think it is. But they can't say no. So what they have to do is find a way to say yes. And that means different stages, different screens they have to put in place, different, you know, bureaucratic and regulatory roadblocks. And if she clears them, then you make the fight. But he's not wrong for being apprehensive. Like some people think, oh, just make the fight. Not so fast. The UFC 100 anniversary. Luke, the five-year anniversary of UFC 100 is coming up, which means it has been 5 years since MMA has peaked. Yeah, it's true. Would Luke Thomas from 2009 be surprised where MMA is at now? God, would I be surprised where MMA is at now? A little bit, yeah. Would you have thought it would have been bigger? Any of the things that surprised you, a woman being MMA's biggest star, for example, that's definitely a big one. Let's see. I would say the thinness of cards is surprising. The thing that gets to me about Zuffa's global expansion, I don't know if that would be so surprising. Obviously, I'd be, you know, surprised with Strikeforce going away and stuff like that, and Bellator being where it is and so forth. The only thing that gets me about, like, and this is related to, like, the oversaturation debate, and I don't want to get too much more into it, but the one thing I would say is, like, I do think that going global makes sense because I do think their product is more mobile. Like, I think UFC's right about that. I just don't know why they have to do, like, every place on Earth all at once. I don't know why they can't sort of target things a little more strategically, a little more reserved. We're going to go into Southeast Asia and Latin America. We're not really going to push into Europe that much right now. I don't know why they can't say that, you know, at least not through anything beyond sort of UK and why push into Germany? It's a huge economy, sure, but like the roadblocks are enormous there. Why not put those cards somewhere else in Latin America? Why not, you know, talent there is behind, but if you don't want to fast track it, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know why you have to go global. Why not go sort of spot check where it makes the most sense? And try to push from there, which I think they are to an extent, but even more reserved. Anyway, I guess, this sport is so different, you know. On the one hand, I'd also say on the good side of things, MMA is much more of a sport than it was in 2009, you know. The fighters are better, although our expectations are higher now as a consequence. But I think I would say that, certainly one thing you can point to that you can really give Zuffa credit for is they've turned MMA into part of the sporting diet much more than it was 5 years ago. You know, 5 years ago it was a sport, but it wasn't sort of part of the sporting family. And to an extent it still isn't, I suppose, on some portions it never will be, you know. But relative to what it was in 2009, they have made sports fans accustomed, or at least much more accustomed, to thinking of UFC and MMA as a part of the sort of sporting ecosystem, when I don't think they did that maybe 5 years ago. Let me work backwards here. Stefan Struve, where should he go from here? I don't think he should retire yet, but certainly I would like to see much more medical examination going on. You know, we're talking about safety first, then let's take that, let's actually mean that, you know. And if you can't come back, then you can't come back, but I'm not ready to say he's fine, just come right back. Let's do some more testing. I'm not a medical doctor, but certainly whatever medical screening is prudent at this juncture, let's make sure that happens, and it happens twice. Sideline reporting. Luke, do you think it would be a good idea for the UFC to institute some sort of additional sideline reporting, i.e. Aaron Andrews style? They do some of that for their preview shows. For instance, like Ariel Helwani does some of that. For instance, in the Uriah Hall fight, he clearly suffered a gruesome injury and fought through it, but wouldn't it have been added to the story to have an additional commentator to go talk to his corner man and report on specifics of the injury? Certainly that's what I'm instructed to do at Glory. Now, I wasn't at the – I only fill in when Mauro's gone, and then Ron fills in for Mauro, then I fill in for Ron. So I'm not really – I'm not part of the product beyond that, but that's certainly my role there when that happened. So I wasn't in Turkey when Spong broke his leg, but here's the problem, man. Like, their broadcast is full, dude. It's really full. You can't go over your allotted time. You might have to pay back the cable companies if you do that, because they repeat the pay-per-view after the three-hour mark. At least on, you know, providers like DirecTV. And the other point is, like, you should see them. These shows, people don't realize this, they don't just fly by the seat of their pants or have a loose plan. You're gonna tell me I'm crazy, but I'm not, because I only learned this initially doing MMA Uncensored, but certainly now that I've done the Glory show. Everything is timed. Every piece of production element, everything, is timed down to the second. And they have a situation where if all the fights go long or if all the fights go short, how much time do they have? And they can add pieces and subtract pieces as the broadcast goes on. But all of that is timed, and it's in liner notes down to what it should be and when it should happen and how it should happen. All that's timed. So as it currently stands, there's simply no way to do that. And I think UFC likes a sort of a streamlined broadcast. But I'm with you in the sense that I would like to see the UFC play with their production format a lot. They're good about introducing new graphics, but I just feel like their production, certainly their pre-fight hype, for the most part, is pretty stale. Listen, if it doesn't work, just get rid of it. They used to do, Eddie Bravo used to do like what Harold Letterman does for HBO. He would have his unofficial scorecard. I'd like to see them bring that back. I like that kind of stuff, you know. I feel like that enhances the broadcast. Play with it. Remember what we always talked about? What are you going to do about John Jones' eye pokes? How about showing the referee, talking to John Jones before the fight, don't put your hands in his mother effing face. Just don't do it. You do it one time, I'm taking a point. Everyone starts on the same place. That's what I'd like to see. So sure, I don't know that they will. In fact, I don't. They're creatures of habit in some ways, but try it. It may not work. It may be a terrible idea in the end, but I don't see why attempting it doesn't at least deserve some kind of note. Weidman cardio and his ceiling. Luke, do you think Weidman has a legit cardio issue, or would you chalk it up to him having banged up knees which prevented him from working on his cardio during the fight. Also, with a performance like that, despite his bad training camp, is there no ceiling for this guy, as DC noted? Would that be a fair assessment, or is it too soon to say? Surely being able to hold his own, standing up with both Silva and Machida, deserves some credit. Well, I mean, yes, of course. I don't want to overreach or underreach here. On the one hand, I thought his cardio was an issue, because the second it faded, Machida was right back in the fight. That's a problem, right? But he was coming off surgery. He had a hand issue. You know, and the other thing about it is, even when he's tired, he has unbelievable grit. Like, remember, he made weight for that, the bearded donk, who, Italian guy. God, I can't remember his name. He gets knocked out all the time. Alessio Sicara. You know, when Weidman fought Sicara, he cut like 50 pounds in 10 days, something absurd, and he did it. You know, and he was obviously gassed the whole time. He still gutted through. And he gutted through this time, too. So he still is able to rise to the occasion. But remember, he's 30 years old. Chris Weidman's not in his 20s anymore. I think he just turned 30, but still. So, yes, there is a ceiling on him. I don't think he can keep up this growth for much longer, maybe a year or two more at best, if he can stay healthy, which by itself is no guarantee. But I would say that I don't know that I would pinpoint him as having a cardio problem just yet. How concerned should I be for MMA's future? Luke, over the course of the last few months, I have noticed increasingly negative events that have made me worried about MMA's future. Dwindling pay-per-view sales, fight nights, and tough ratings hitting an all-time low on FS1, the decline of some international markets such as Brazil and Canada, as well as a huge PED issue. On top of all this, my friends who are casual MMA fans are tuning in less to UFC, and mostly because there's simply too many events for them to keep up with. How concerned are you with MMA's future, or am I just being a negative Nancy? Well, let me say that you are right to be concerned. Certainly I am concerned. Why would I not be concerned? I quit my line of work to do this. This is how I pay my mortgage, right? I plan on having a family next year. Like, that's how I'm going to take care of them. So certainly if it's an interest to me, but I'm not going to come up here and just tell you things that aren't true. And I'm not going to come up here and do my job poorly by just declining to say the truth or what promoters want me to say. I'm just not going to do it, you know? I don't think MMA is ever going to go away. I think that because it is global, it will always exist in some capacity or another. But I am worried about the current stage that we are in, to just put it mildly. I don't know that expansion in the current way that it's happening is going to work, and I certainly can say with confidence that it has its costs. I don't think this will kill the sport by a stretch of the imagination, but although I suppose anything's possible, but I don't think that's likely. What I do worry about, though, is that we have a global sport with a low level of popularity everywhere. They may succeed in making it global, but I don't know how you sustain a global sports product by one company. I just don't see how that's possible. I don't think it is. I don't think you see it in any other sport for a reason, because it's just not possible. You know, FIFA is a regulatory body, not a company in that sense. And there's Champions League, La Liga, and Champions League is different, but there's La Liga, there's EPL, MLS, but they're different things. They mean different things to different people, and they're managed differently, and they're run differently, and all sorts of incredible differences. There's not a unique standard. So listen, you're right to be concerned, but certainly I am. I don't know which way it's going to go, but this is why when it's like people are like, there's no such thing as oversaturation. It's like, dude, you are a frog in the pot, and the water is getting hotter. And you heard the analogy, right? Like the frog jumps into the pot when the water's cold, and as it increasingly gets hot, by the time it's boiling, it's too late. Don't be that one. Like, oversaturation is not some made-up phony thing that I'm talking about just because I have nothing else to talk about. It's real, and I'm trying to figure out what it means. Featherweight interim title. Is it unreasonably early to talk about an interim title holder for Jose Aldo when he's ready to fight 45 days later and has fought more recently than both Cain and Pettis have. That one surprised me too. Like, my only thought about that is that the guy gets injured all the time. All the time. And by the way, did I hear something that somebody said? Ah, some cheap seats thing. Dang, I have to listen to it more closely before I... before I bring that up, I just want to listen to it more closely. But point being is, my initial response to that was they must worry that he's just going to be injured all the time, or that he won't be able to recover in the time that he says, or that there's something else that we don't know about that's keeping him from being ready at a certain time. Almost like a threat to him. You know, either you're going to fight for us or just not. You know. Dana almost became indignant at the post-fight scrum when asked about oversaturation. All right, I've already talked about that enough. Eddie Gordon, Corey Anderson. Do you think they have a bright career ahead of them since they won Tough 19? I know Gordon trains with Weidman. They both look like promising prospects. Diego Lima does as well. I would hold your horses on anybody that came out of that show. Not saying they're going to be do poorly, but manage your expectations about how high they can go. I didn't see anything that particularly told me that they would, but still pretty early in their career, so we'll see how they progress. Do you think Faber will ever wear UFC gold? No, unfortunately. Newell Gaethje, what did you think of this fight when you saw it? A lot of critics are going to go off on it, but I thought it was fine for the World Series of Fighting main event. Thoughts, please. Yeah, boy, that was a beating. You know, listen, if you're MMA uninitiated, that probably looked like torture porn to you. Because the problem was, it wasn't like Gaethje took him down, took his back, and then choked him out, and well, that was it, you know. Jesus, Gaethje, man, he just does violence to people, you know. You fight Justin Gaethje, it looks like you got hit with shrapnel. Yeah, and that's exactly what happened. Like, the problem was, Newell looked good for, like, the first half of a round, first, you know, 4 minutes of a round, and then it all just sort of went downhill from there. He just couldn't withstand the, because they fight the same way. Both guys are attack, 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 and I just thought that Gaethje's attack would be a little bit more potent, and it was, obviously. I can imagine, though, if you don't know what you're looking at, if you don't know that the MMA is properly regulated, if you don't know, well, it was the state, that was in Florida, so, you know, it was an open question of how properly regulated that it is, but nevertheless, you know, Nick Newell has a license to fight in Nevada, so he'd be fine, but if you didn't know anything, you thought you were watching, you know, bum fights or something, right? Like, oh, look what this cage fighting thing is. They've got a guy in there missing half of an arm fighting a fully abled guy. Like, this is gross and exploitative. That's what you would think. And I actually complimented NBC and World Series of Fighting because they didn't make too much of a deal of Newell's congenital amputee issue. I thought, you know what, it deserves mention, but not a whole lot. In the end, though, I probably could have done a little bit more to educate the viewers, given that this was on NBC. If it was on NBC Sports or this is taking place on Spike, I don't know that I would have cared as much, but it was on NBC. Maybe they could have done a little bit more to assure the viewers that what they were watching was at least a thoroughly regulated event, because I just don't think folks realize that. But at the same time, I stick to what I said last week, which was, if people are offended by it because, you know, ignorance of what's going on is not an excuse, right? I mean, we have to sort of, like, be appreciative of the fact that, or at least cognizant of the fact that folks are not going to have a deep understanding of the mechanics of MMA, you know, the regulatory universe. Okay, fine, so some hand-holding is required, but not all the hand-holding in the world. And I'm sorry, like, we're just going to look at the world and say, well, people with disabilities, because you're a liability for the sensibilities of somebody else, we're just not going to allow you to do things. Man, F off. Like, the world doesn't work that way. You know what? Nick Newell took a beating, but lots of guys in MMA take beatings. And it's okay. You can't just pretend that you don't have to do anything about folks who don't know anything about it. But at the same time, if there are some folks who are outraged and horrified, oh, well. Nick Newell deserved that shot. And whether it was prudent to put him on NBC is a different argument. But did he deserve a title shot against Justin Gaethje? Yeah, he did. And Did he deserve to be put in the main event slot? Yes, he did. And that's really the end of it as far as I'm concerned. Luke, do you think the UFC is committing promotional malpractice by not promoting Chris Weidman more? Should he have been making the promotional rounds, Kimmel, Fallon, Letterman, Regis? Dude, I don't understand. I don't understand what folks... Do folks not understand how these shows work? You don't tell Conan O'Brien and Letterman and Fallon who you're going to promote. Listen, I need the booking agent for the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Yeah, Steve or Maurice or Jennifer, whatever your effing name is. We got this guy who's going to fight in a week. We're going to put him on your show. Hey, by the way, could you bump, I don't know, who's an A-list star? Can you bump Hugh Jackman, who's promoting the new X-Men movie? Because you know what? We think our guy's more important. Yeah, get on that stat. And by the way, only red M&Ms in the dressing room. Click. Like, that's not how it works, dog. They call you. Now, you can pitch to them what you want, but they're probably going to go tell you to F off because they know who they want. It does not work that way. This is why star power matters. This is why everyone's like, John Jones is this, John Jones is that. John Jones is the only one getting on Michael and whatever her name is, Kelly. I guess Michael's now on the Good Morning America. It doesn't work that you don't call them up. You can try and pitch them, but it probably won't work. And by the way, some of these shows have agreements where if you go on Fallon, you can't go on Letterman, or you can't go on Conan. I don't know if you know that. So it's not like you can just make the rounds. You can go on one, and maybe they did call. I know I talked to a woman who used to work in UFC PR who said they would make calls, and these places will just tell them to go pound sand. It doesn't work that way. MMA is not what you think it is. You have to build somebody so big that those guys have to ask you to come on. Please be our guest. That's how it works. Luke Rockhold, I believe aside from Jacare, the only one in the middleweight division who would pose a threat to Weidman is Rockhold. Yeah, because they're similar fighters. Rockhold has excellent takedown defense, good jiu-jitsu, is long, can strike, but I think he'd get backed up, and I think he'd get taken down against Chris Weidman. Could be wrong, though, man. Could be a hell of a fight. Yeah, we already talked about Ronda. Why couldn't they put the remaining fights on Fight Pass like you suggested in the past? I'm not sure about that because they owe pay-per-view providers. My guess is that the rest of here's my guess. I don't know this to be sure, but my guess is that they thought they could just buttress the strength of the remaining cards on the calendar by just moving these fights over. And that they'd eventually still have their main event, which is not something they want. They didn't want to just lose this event to Fight Pass, where not a lot of people would see it. And I think that's it. I think they thought not a lot of people would see it. We do better against these guys by putting them somewhere else. I don't know what the rules are, though, with contracted pay-per-views about what has to happen. Either you have it or you don't have it. That remains a mystery to me. Is this cancellation of UFC 176 worse than 151? Well, there's less fallout for the fighters involved because it's not ostensibly Aldo's fault that he gets injured. But that's hilarious to me. You know, they didn't lose both guys. And they even had a substitute for 151. Sonnen was at least willing to step up. They got nobody. Nobody. But the cards aren't too thin. Kennedy Romero, yeah, man, this fight's going to be ridiculous. Do you like this matchup? I do. Who would you favor in the grappling department? Also, what does Romero's takedown defense seem lacking for a wrestler of his caliber? It's not lacking for a wrestler of his caliber. It's just that he's so wild with his striking, he leaves himself open. In a wrestling match, Kennedy wouldn't last 10 seconds, man. And I like Kennedy. I think he's a good wrestler. I think he's a hell of an athlete. Obviously, you know, American War Hero, all that good stuff, but... Here's what I would say. Kennedy's definitely going to lose the wrestling battle pretty handily, but he might be able to win the grappling battle. You know, he might be able to recapture guard and get sweeps. He might be able to go for arm bars. Romero is good at, like, you know, aggro, pick you up, slam you, and then land big strikes. But his, if you notice, he doesn't really engage too much positionally in the grappling department. He does a little bit. I'm not saying he doesn't engage. He's probably training and rolling all the time. But in terms of an MMA context, that's not something he's comfortable with. I can see him overcommitting and making a mistake there. So Kennedy's not out of it by any stretch, but certainly he's going to get some, you know, as they say, he's going to get some frequent flyer miles on that one. This is interesting. Luke, in a fight with a wrestler versus a non-wrestler, so for example, Weidman versus Machida, there appears to be a running theme whereby the wrestler is usually the guy moving forward and more often than not is usually hoping that the forward pressure will result in some kind of takedown if the striker decides to stand his ground or come forward. My question is, at what point would you consider one guy or the other to be winning or losing? I've heard Rashad Evans say that being the person moving forward means that you're winning, whereas I've heard Phil Davis mention that attempting more takedowns means you are winning. And also in round 5 of the Weidman-Machida fight, Weidman took Machida down, passed his guard into mount, took his back with both hooks in, and then took the hooks out, and Machida was able to stand back up. I scored the fight 3-2 Weidman mainly because even though Weidman landed a takedown and got position, the process amounted to no more than a reset in the fifth. Any thoughts on this would be great. Thank you. All right, so I'm not going to be mean because he asked a really nice question. Dude, if you get taken down, someone passes your guard, mounts you, and takes your back, it would take an awful lot to lose. Defense, this is in the Unified Rules, defense is its own reward. There is no reward given to you for getting out of back control. You just got handled. And the problem with you putting yourself in those environments is it's not the same as getting rocked, right, where you're doing demonstrable damage. You can understand that, okay? Grappling is different. Yes, there are situations where the arm's extended and you're trying to fight out of it. Nah, maybe he won't get it. And those situations are analogous, but you have to have appreciation for positional control. Dude, folks, listen to me. Grappling is hard to do. You have another human being resisting you, and they know how to do it. To get someone flat on their back and pass their first line of defense, then their second line of defense, then their third line of defense, you are creating an environment where you are leaving them almost no options. If they get out of that, then fine. That's the reward. They're no longer in that bad position. But you must credit somebody for controlling another person and creating an environment where they are much closer to losing, where they are much more helpless, where they have a limited amount of offense. Dude, if you get your back taken, you are in trouble. You are in trouble. If you get out of it, awesome. All respect to you. You are in trouble. Fact. Okay? Jiu-jitsu doesn't count if you only lock in a rear naked choke. It doesn't count if you only extend an arm bar or catch a kimura. It counts when you control somebody because everything about jiu-jitsu comes from that. There are guys who have really awful positioning that sometimes can catch you in an arm bar or sometimes, you know, whip around and take the back, but it's pretty rare, man. It's position before submission. And so when you don't give guys the credit for that, you take away what really makes jiu-jitsu, jiu-jitsu. You will spend much more time in jiu-jitsu focusing on positioning than you will submissions. Because if you don't have positioning, you're not going to beat anybody good. And when you do that in an MMA context, which isn't even pure jiu-jitsu, in an MMA context, if you put someone in, like, why does mount matter? Tell me why mount matters. What's the answer? What is the value of being in mount? Number one, your punches hurt more because you have gravity affecting them. That's the first. But the real answer is that you have passed their ability for them to use their legs. Even in side control, they can use their legs. They can at least swivel around. You have pinned them behind them, behind you. That's the value of mount. That's what that mount means. And when you take someone's back, what does that mean? Your offense all goes this direction. So if someone gets behind you, all your offense goes this direction. You notice that you said that Machida escaped the position. He didn't do any offense from there because no offense exists from there, or almost none. 99% of back control, if you're the person who has your back taken, is a getting out. That's it. It's just defending. That is it. If you're circling the cage, you can at least put your hands down for a second, right? If me and you are facing each other, I can put my hands down for a second and walk away. I have to bring them back up eventually. Put your hands down for 1 second with just Chris Weidman on your back. What's going to happen? Your neck's going to get taken like that. He's creating an environment where his ability to exact offense is much more powerful, and your precipice of getting finished, you being pushed to the precipice of getting finished, has been much closer reached. You won't always get there. In fact, more often than not, you're probably not going to get there because grappling is hard. But you have to respect the positioning. You have to conceptually understand what it means. What does it mean to be in side control? It means I have you flat on your back. You have to be on a hip to escape. You'll never escape flat on your back. You have to be on a shoulder. You have to be on a hip. You have to be on an elbow. If I have you flat on your back, that means I can now move to a better position on the mat. I can go to knee on belly. I have gravity on my side. I have you with your arms away from your body. That means I have kimuras. You don't have anything, or at least very, very little. It's not just a position that we're just making up because it counts in jiu-jitsu. It matters because it conceptually means something. UFC 177, 7 weeks and a half and almost nothing. Considering how important pay-per-views are for the company and how much they represent for both hardcore and more casual fans, should we worry that almost 7 weeks before UFC 177, there's really nothing scheduled for it? So far, we have many people think it's too soon or simply not the right fight to make thanks to the cancellation of 176. We have Correa versus Baszler and possibly Rothwell versus Magomedov. Considering how long a fighter needs to be prepared, I think it's definitely another bad repercussion of oversaturation. Let me see 177 here. Well, there's two fight nights in between them. Three fight nights, looks like. Yeah, Dillashaw versus Burr. Here's what we have for 177. There's three fight nights in between them. Just keep that in mind. Dillashaw versus Barao, Correa versus Baszler, Ferguson versus Castillo, Larkin versus Brunson. Yeah, it's not very good. And how would they have even filled that if it hadn't been for a cancel? You would lose three of those fights if there wasn't UFC 176 cancellation. How on earth were they going to fill that? How on earth were they going to fill that? And by the way, you have to go over Henderson versus Dos Anjos pay-per-view. You have to go over Bisping versus Lee. You have to go over Bader versus St. Preux. All three of those fight nights. You have to go through over all of them. Now, there's nothing really on the main one, like the state main. Let's see. For Fight Night Kung Lee, you've got Bisping, Woodley versus Dong Kyung Kim. And then for Henderson versus Dos Anjos, you have Wilson Hayes, Tim Elliott. That's a good fight. Benson Henderson versus Rafael Dos Anjos. Amazing fight. Mirsad Bektic is back. That's cool. Jordan Meehan, Brandon Thatch, that's a killer fight. Mike Pyle versus Demian Maia, it's a good fight. Francis Carmona, Talas Lightsies, it's okay. And then, of course, you had James Vick and then Benil Dariush moved up. So, like, you know, they have fights to fill, but just they have so many cards. Dominic Cruz, do you think Dominic Cruz will be able to win his upcoming fight? Yes. And if he does, who do you think he should get next? Title shot against Dillashaw or fight against Faber? It depends entirely on how he looks. If he looks great, if he looks like 2 years never passed, hey, I wouldn't mind a title talk. Because Mizugaki is legit bantamweight, man. Whatever else you want to think about Mizugaki, he is a credentialed fighter. But if he looks a little bit slow, there's some issues, if he gets taken down, we'll see. We'll see. I think it depends entirely on how he looks. Canelo versus Lara. You know, I like Canelo. I'm going to root for Arislandi Lara. It's going to be hard for me to root against guys who escaped Castro's Cuba to have a better life. I don't know, you know. As the former editor of Bloody Elbow, do you find it noble or douchey of Brent Brookhouse to be digging up dirt on fighters that often lead to them being fired? I don't know if I call it noble or douchey. I call it part of his job. And I have no issue with it whatsoever. Ben Askren, Johnny Hendricks, Matt Hughes. Did you see the exchange on Twitter between these three? Yes, I did. Thoughts on Askren's antics this past weekend? Do you side with Askren, who cites the success of Chael Sonnen, or do you side with Hughes, who didn't like Askren's antics and didn't believe it would help him? How do you not side with Ben Askren? You have oversaturation. You let Ben Askren walk to 1FC. Everyone's like, he's so boring. Yeah, but you hate his guts because of what he says on the microphone. Chael Sonnen is some sort of like exciting, you know, let me bang bro kind of fighter. If Chael Sonnen had the personality of, you know, Jim Miller, who I like very much and respect very much, would he be anywhere where he is? No. And Jim Miller is where he is because he fights balls out amazing. Right? I mean, just be real. Just be real. Ben Askren would get you to watch, especially if he's fighting better competitors that would force him into more difficult scrambles. He'd be much more. He's not very exciting when he's just laying on top of dudes or in mount when they just can't do anything about it. But the guys in the UFC can do something about it. It's crazy to me. You got Paul Daly, we can't sign Paul Daly because he sucker punched Josh Koscheck. Big deal. He said he was sorry. I thought this was the same organization that believed that when guys do things wrong, you're supposed to forgive them down the line if they show real repentance and they serve their time. Has he served his time? He served his time. Bring Paul Daly back. He's not some like world beater, but Christ, it enhances the value of a card a little bit. And Ben Askren most certainly does. And look at what Matt Hughes said. Matt Hughes said, I don't doubt your talent. You're a legit talent. Well, what is the issue? Pettiness is the issue. Brazil versus Germany. Thoughts on the ass whooping the Germans gave the Brazilians. I'm not going to give you terrible, you know, soccer analysis, but what I would tell you is 538 has some pretty interesting analysis about it. What do you think the Colombians could have done better? They could have gotten some referees who better officiated, because the Brazilians know this and they'll admit this. They hammered James Rodriguez throughout that game. And the first time he commits a foul, they give him a yellow card. What a bunch of nonsense. And by the way, FIFA investigated Zuniga and found nothing wrong with what he did. So I thought that they could have gotten some better referees. Now, admittedly, some of the Brazilians got some bad calls too in that game, but they went after James Rodriguez, and they know they did. Argentina-Netherlands. I hope Argentina wins, but I think the Netherlands will. I think I've already answered another. I'm not going to do any more oversaturation questions. Dana says the UFC's doing better than ever. Luke, there's been a lot of talk about declining pay-per-view sales due to oversaturation. However, what do you think of Dana saying the UFC's doing better than ever? I think as the president of the company, what else would you say? Ben Folks, are you a fan of Ben Folks? I am. Did you see the piece he wrote calling for the firing of Chael Sonnen from Fox shortly before it happened? I think I did. What is your opinion on media members publicly campaigning for athletes and commentators to lose their jobs? It's not something I would do except in the rarest of circumstances, like outright explicitly say this guy should lose his job. But if that's how Ben feels as a writer, he should say that. If that's how he legitimately feels, and I'm sure that it is, you should say the things that you mean. The last thing you want a writer to do is like, well, I'm going to be careful about my... I mean, you want to be careful in the sense you don't want to say things you don't believe or things you can't defend. But if you do both of the things, if you think clearly about something and you make an argument about it, and it's a reasonable, rational argument, even if you don't agree, you should let a writer do that. You should let a writer argue a position, even if it's one you don't agree. Because I'm speaking as an editor now. Because if you don't, you're really not going to get the best of them. The best of them is when someone thinks through an idea and all the possible counterarguments about what it means and why he should say it. So high praise for him. What can Lyoto Machida learn from BJ Penn? That's a funny question. Looking back, it seems that BJ's career took a turn for the worse after he had lost twice to the title holders in each of the weight classes he fought in, GSP and Frankie Edgar. Now it seems like Machida may find himself in similar territory. He's one of the best at 205 and at 185, but unless something major changes, I can't imagine he'll get another title shot anytime soon in either division. How can Machida avoid ending his career the way BJ did? It's not the same. I mean, at 205, you know, I don't know. I mean, he got put to sleep with a standing guillotine. That's a bad sign. Maybe that's not for you. Okay, fine. But at 185, listen, he was getting controlled in the first three rounds, and, you know, dominated might be a strong word, but not the most inappropriate word ever. But I thought Machida looked pretty good, all things considered. I thought in the fourth round, he had better gas than Chris Weidman, and he looked like a serious threat. And even in that fifth round when Weidman tried to rally, he was landing. I didn't think he looked that bad at all. I didn't think that that was, you know, I don't know that he'll beat Chris Weidman, but, you know, BJ, like, basically, like, quit on the stool in the GSP fights. And in the Frankie Edgar fights, he just couldn't get any offense really going. You know, maybe in the first fight he could, but not the second one. And the third one, God, Jesus, that was just hard to watch, you know. But Machida looked pretty good. You can make, I don't think he did, but you can make a claim that he won two of those three rounds, you know. Certainly won the fourth. So yeah. I don't think he needs to hang it up at 185. Now he is 36. That may change in a year. But based on how he looked against Chris Weidman, he fought Chris Weidman. And he didn't get finished, and he put it on Chris Weidman, you know. So that looks pretty good. Machida's legacy. Do you think Saturday's main event did anything for Machida's legacy as a fighter? Personally, I think he righted some wrongs with that performance and has proven that 5 years from the ill-fated Machida era, he can still compete at a championship level. Completely agree. Whether or not he will ever win again the belt, I think this fight with Weidman will cement him as a warrior and will perhaps not a legend. Certainly a great. Definitely a great. He legitimately captured a UFC title. Now, obviously he wasn't able to hold on to it for very long, but you know, one of the things that Dana and Lorenzo have said a long time, and I think they're right, is that these guys in MMA, they have all different kinds of stories and different kinds of backgrounds. There's something, you know, unique and mysterious and very fictional. And like, I don't mean that in a fraudulent way. I mean that in an affectionate way. There's something poetic about the nature of Lyoto Machida and the way he fights. And he's made the game better, you know. He's made the game better by being in it. He has uniquely contributed something. He's the first guy. There were other guys. Do you guys remember? I think his name was Jeff Newton. And I think his nickname was a Karate Kid. And he fought, let's see, if I'm not mistaken, he fought on a UFC card. I'm looking this up here. Yeah, and it was his last fight. He lost, but he fought Sam Hooger, UFC 56. He contributed karate, but no one had really come forward with a style like that, you know, revolutionized in many ways how we think about footwork and distancing and what works and what doesn't. And when guys come in like that, they expand. I've often said it, like the front kick to the face that Silva did on Machida, once one guy does it, the technique, as I like to say, becomes democratized. You know, it becomes available to everybody. Everybody can now use it. Because they didn't think it was possible before. Machida has done that in a number of different realms. And by the way, he was able to, as you saw, in a different way, you know, front kick Randy Couture at UFC 129. So, you know, what's Machida's legacy? Certainly an all-time great's a strong word, of a high-level elite competitor in two-way classes. Won a title in one, fought for title in two. That's pretty damn great. But more importantly, expanded the scope of what high-level mixed martial arts can look like and did so uniquely in a very, very... He didn't have other contemporaries at the same time, at least not up until recently. Now you've got guys like, you know, Gunnar Nelson and Justin Scoggins, and they have that sideways karate thing, but man, you know, his is a little bit different, obviously, but Machida was really that first guy to completely change what you thought was possible, at least in terms of karate. Let's see, Jose Aldo. Someone accuses UFC of not building up their female fighters as contenders. It's hard to build up people who are just not on the level, dude, and UFC knows it. And by the way, wait until they see what they do with the 115-pounders. Let's move to Twitter real quick before I get out of here. Now that they've both been humanized, GSP not as much, any clearer view on who would have won a GSP-Anderson fight? God, that's a good question. GSP wouldn't finish him. That's the problem. GSP could take him down, but he would never finish him. I don't know. I guess probably Silva. Let's see. How many questions on Twitter today, y'all? Let's see. Declining popularity of leg locks in MMA. Why have leg locks declined in popularity among MMA fighters? Recently, we tend to see very few leg submissions in a typical MMA bout, and fighters don't often go for them that often. This wasn't the case in the early years of the UFC, with the exception of Husamor Pajares and Marcin Held, neither of whom is fighting in the UFC anymore or at all. Are there any leg specialists out there, in your opinion? Here's the problem. There's takedowns where, like, for example, if I grab you by the waist and I suck your hips into mine and I trip your leg and we fall back and you land on your back, that's a trip, right? Or I get a double leg takedown, I land on top, maybe I land in side control, that's a takedown. Even with a judo throw, bang. Let's say I pick the one Nate Diaz likes. So someone gets underhooked, throw a wizard, and you hit a Harai Goshi, right? Boom, they go on their back, you go on top. Those are standard takedowns, and you land hips flat down every time, right? There's another kind of throw, right? It's called like a sacrifice throw, where you actually give up your back for the throw. Now, not that they take your back, but your back has to go to the mat, right? And that's why they call it a sacrifice throw, because you're sacrificing dominant position to establish it. Even just for a split second, though, because if it works, obviously then it works, but there's a bit of a tension there. I kind of look at leg locks like sacrifice throws, because you can get them, but you know, that's why you don't see a lot of arm bars from mount anymore. You'll see arm bars from the guard sometimes, or triangle arm bar combos, but no one wants to be in mount, and then unless it's the very end of the round, spin for the arm bar and then lose it. Because why? You're on your back. Look what happened to Dennis Holman, who did it to John Fitch again, after he got blasted out by Frank Trigg doing that back at UFC like 46 or something like that. Goes for the leg lock, and what happens? Trigg turns into him and just gives him the knuckle sandwich. Leg locks are the same way. If you're not, and they're hard to get. Like Husamor Pajares is pretty deadly with them, but if you don't get them right away, man, people are going to escape, and you're going to be in a bad spot. It's like a sacrifice throw of submissions. So to me, the reason why you just don't see them is because guys just aren't good at recovering from them. One last one, very quickly, Luke Hall of Fame. It was up to you. Who would you induct into the UFC Hall of Fame next year? You could induct up to two people: Frank Shamrock and Mark Coleman's already in it, right? Dan Severn's already in it. Probably BJ Penn. BJ Penn and Frank Shamrock. How about that? All right, folks, we are out of here. Let me say thanks to at Dark Toby, DarkTobby, for the microphone. I'll use it next time. That's unbelievably generous of you to do that. Super, super kind, man. And this just proves that, like, it's not just my chat, it's yours too, you know? Obviously, I have no budget, so thanks to you guys. I have a microphone. I greatly appreciate that. You can email me, luke.thomas@sbnation.com. You may follow me on Twitter, @sbnlukethomas. There are no fights this weekend. Thank you, sweet, merciful Jesus. And I appreciate everyone watching. Until next time, stay frosty.